Welcome to everyone who has tuned in on our podcast or watching on the YouTube channel. In this episode, we have professional rock climber, and I could also call him perhaps alpine climber as well, Robbie Phillips, who has got a climbing CV which is really, really broad. He's got so many different disciplines under his belt. He's performing at a really high sport level, red pointed up to 8C+. He's climbed multiple hard, scary trad routes up to E9. He's bouldered up to V12. He's big walled some really, really tricky stuff around the world. He's also represented his country in sport climbing. He's kind of done it all, a proper, you know, all-round rock climber. He's from Scotland. He's 31 years old. I think that sort of leads us straight into getting on to talk about what makes up Robbie. Oh, and also shouldn't forget, you're also a professional YouTuber nowadays.
Yeah, just now I can call myself a professional YouTuber, yourself.
You're a professional YouTuber and pro athlete, which is becoming a little bit more common nowadays, isn't it?
Yeah, no, certainly. But man, definitely doing the YouTube is way harder than doing the climbing, I think.
Yeah. Well, I'm really looking forward to kind of teasing out some of the stuff that you've learned over your climbing career so far. And I've known you for a number of years now, and what I think is going to be really interesting is seeing in particular some of the approaches that you've taken with, you know, your energy and mindset and commitment to your climbing. And I think it really stands out compared to a lot of other people. And, you know, you're only 31, you've achieved a lot already. And I think that's really impressive. So I want to kind of just work out for, you know, partly myself as well, but also the audience, what has allowed you to go so far so quickly. So tell me a bit about your younger years, and how did that whole competition climbing, junior elite climbing thing happen, and what did that look like for you at what ages?
Right, yeah. So I guess like from the very beginning, you know, I started indoors at just like a local climbing wall in Edinburgh when I was 15 years old. And, you know, the second I started climbing, I was, you know, absolutely obsessed. You know, I just loved climbing so much. And I think I just invested so much time into it over, you know, a very short period of time. I never found anything that I was, before climbing, I never found anything that I was particularly good at or particularly passionate about in any way. And I know particularly, I think, because I didn't have much of a social scene at school, I struggled with school and kind of coming into climbing, and suddenly I had a social scene and people, you know, people I think said I was good, but you know, it's kind of just like, I don't think I was naturally very good at climbing. I think it was just like a, you know, encouraging the youth sort of thing. And of course you respond really well to that. And of course then you want to do it more. And then I just climbed a lot. And I was really, my dad was aware of that. And she'd take me down to the wall, and you know, 4 days a week after school, and she'd let me stay there till 10 o'clock, and she'd just sit on the sofa and wait for me, you know, until I was old enough to like be there on my own. And, you know, I think say for the first, year, 2 years, there was no like training or anything. It was just like a lot of climbing, you know, between like the ages of like, I think 15 and 17, it was just tons and tons of climbing. You know, going to the wall, trying hard, in with a good group of people, and it was just pretty much volume, I think, that kind of got me there. And then as I progressed, I got introduced to sort of competition climbing, and there was a couple of guys who worked at the wall who were coaches and ended up becoming like sort of my mentors, and they kind of helped guide me kind of into the competition circuit, but also at the same time kind of teaching me all the sort of skills that you learn outdoors, and then also teaching me how to train better for my goals in climbing as well. And then I had this goal from quite early on that I wanted to be the best climber I could be, and competitions, I guess, at that time when I was younger and living in Edinburgh, not easy access to local crags, competition was like what I naturally gravitated to, because I wanted to perform, I wanted to, you know, be the best I could be. And so eventually I got into the kind of British climbing team and competed for a couple of years internationally for the junior team, basically. And that was kind of the progression as a youth, I guess.
And how quick would you say, as a junior climber, you went through that transition from, you know, I think most people when they start out climbing, you know, even when they're fit kids, come in at that 6A, 6B kind of standard. How quickly did it take you to get to, you know, that 6A to 7A, to 7B plus to 8A? Was it just a year or two? Was it 5 years? What did that look like?
It was actually a year and a half to get to 7B plus. And I remember that because 7B plus is the grade where I start taking things seriously, even now. Like today I did a 7B plus at like the local crag, and I didn't realize it was 7B plus, and I did it, and I came down and I thought it had been 7B, and so I approached it quite nonchalant because 7B is okay in my mind. But somebody said, oh yeah, that's 7B plus, and I was like, oh really? Oh, I'm pretty chuffed with that, actually. So it's like, I think it's like a marker in my mind ever since then that 7B plus was a grade I got to within a year and a half of climbing. And I remember that was my first time I had to actually try and to actually like project something. But of course, I mean, I didn't like walk into climbing. I wasn't climbing that hard. I remember like it took me, I think, like 6 months to get to the point where I could climb 6C. I can visually remember my first 6C. And then I think it was like a year again before I kind of broke into the sevens, and then seven, but in seven, everything felt very quick. You know, I felt like I was breaking through barriers really, really quickly. And then all of a sudden it was 70 plus, and that was the first marker, the first stopping point. So it was probably like, you know, 16 and a half or something, climbed 70 plus. And actually I remember I went outdoor climbing. So I went to Kalymnos with my family when I was kind of come, I think I was 16 at the time. And they took me on a trip to Kalymnos, and I managed to climb my first 7C out there. Although I think 7C in Kalymnos is maybe a bit different, but I just remember that was a really big deal for me as well, climbing hard on rock.
And did you do quite a lot of bouldering as well as a junior athlete? Because I'm always fascinated how quickly the, you know, your generation and the generation younger move through those grades up to that, you know, 7B plus, 8A standards, just super quick. Because I think it took me 5 years to get beyond maybe 7A plus or something. But I grew up on vert tech climbing, and I barely ever climbed on an overhang. And I'm always fascinated with the difference in these generations as they move through. Do you think it was because you were bouldering more on steeper stuff, or just because it was all indoors?
So I actually have my own thoughts on this. So I think first and foremost, I think it's who I was hanging. You know, I was hanging out with guys who were basically climbing 8A as their kind of, that was the standard they sort of climbed at the upper level at the time when I started anyway. And the other youth climbers at the time, it was about 7B, 7B plus, you know, maybe 7C on the upper end where they were climbing. And so, you know, my competitive younger self was, I want to be the best young climber here. And I guess I would be looking at my coaches, my mentors, and seeing what they were doing and knowing that's achievable, because they had achieved it. And so I think that, you know, this is just that, I think mentally it makes it a lot easier to kind of break down that you can achieve that if you can already see it's happening. And because you've got people that are the same age as you right beside you, I guess they're the competition. So you want to achieve that. In terms of physical training, like bouldering versus route climbing, like I actually did very little bouldering. It was mostly route climbing. I trained mostly at RATHO, Edinburgh International Climbing Arena. And our climbing sessions were like just doing like either, you know, 10 routes in a session on those big walls, or, you know, we would do laps a lot of lap training. We'd usually leave bouldering to the end. You know, looking at it now, it's such a, it's not the way I would train. You know, it's not the way I would approach things. I wouldn't go in and do roots and then I'd boulder afterwards. That's not the way I'd do it. But, you know, I was going in after school and, you know, we finished finished school at 3:30. My mum would pick me up. She'd take me to the wall. I'd be there for probably climbing for, you know, 4:45 sort of thing. And I wouldn't leave until they were turning the lights off in the arena. Like it was a 5-hour session and I wouldn't stop climbing the entire time. I would leave, my hands would be red raw, I'd have a day off and I'd do the same thing the day after. And looking at that now, my sessions are so, like nowadays, my sessions are very rare that my skin's raw at the end. That's very rare. So it was a kind of very different approach, but I think, I guess like the volume I was getting was really good for developing technique. I think that the types of climbs that I was doing, they were very endurance-based, they were very technical. It was very good root setters, like exceptionally good root setters. So I was learning good skills, good technical skills, even indoors from, you know, relatively, you know, at the beginning of my climbing and through training. And I just, and honestly, going back to that sort of mentality of just seeing who the best are and then being like, that's what I want to be. And it's interesting because I guess my mentors, one in particular, Neil McGeeky, you know, me and him ended up, you know, we weren't competitive, but like, I guess he was training really hard as well and he had his goals. And so, and because I was younger than him, I was kind of chasing his coattails, so to speak, you know? And so I guess everything he achieved, then I would kind of try and achieve until the point when I actually surpassed him. And I guess that's the tricky bit is when you surpass the people that you're climbing most regularly with, then, you know, it's kind of harder because then you got to look to somebody else to see, you know, kind of what's achievable, especially the people that you're training with, which I think is why it's really good to train with stronger climbers. And I guess it's why I think that a lot of young climbers now can achieve such high levels so soon because they are just surrounded by people who climb really hard. It's why like Sheffield has such a good strong scene because there's so many strong climbers, and same thing in Innsbruck and the same thing in Boulder, Colorado, I guess.
Yeah, I think it's a really underrated thing that whole, you know, absorption of ability almost by osmosis.
Yeah.
If you hang around with people that are of a certain ability or certain interest or approach within climbing, you just mop it up by spending a lot of time with those people. And it just seeps into your climbing and your ability. And it's one of the things that I try and get people to do when they're, you know, plateauing out at a certain standard. I'll go, have a look at the friends around you, the groups of people that you climb with. Are they all the same kind of standard with you or lower potentially? If they are, see if you can get, you know, at least one session a week with a different group of people. And it's amazing how much you don't have to follow some special training theory or, you know, exact method they do. You'll just absorb it.
Or just ditch all your weak friends and just go for the strong guys. You
it's
guys
so harsh,
are
but... me.
I've outgrown you.
It sounds so harsh, doesn't it? But it does actually work in reality. And that's where I think you had a really cool early, you know, sort of upbringing in your climbing career with the two Neils who were there. And, you know, I know both the Neils, and they're really cool guys, like very, very supportive, just, you know, good to the heart, to the soul. And you saw a lot of good climbers come out of that gym, out of Ratho, I think, you know, largely because of them. Mm-hmm. And yeah. I think that is a thing which I would love to see more of in climbing, because one or two people can have an impact on generations of climbers.
Yeah, no, totally. I actually think that it was because of them, like almost without a doubt, like the number of good climbers that came out of Ratho. I mean, the climbing center itself is a great facility, but you don't need a great facility to create great climbers. And I remember there was like a really good example of this as well up north in Inverness, because I remember Robert McKenzie, his dad, Rory McKenzie, he was also in a similar sense, like the coach, the guy who kind of mustered the kids together. He had the energy and the drive to really kind of push them. And he also had like a really good approach to climbing. And at that time, there was so many strong young climbers coming from the little Inverness wall, which, pardon my friends, was French was absolute shite. You know, like a terrible, terrible wall. Didn't have any sort of training facilities, never did any route setting. And those guys would, you know, once every 3 months come down to Edinburgh for a training session and often mop the floor with all of us.
Yeah.
And I was just like, who are these guys just showing up randomly, you know? And it just, it was more like the sort of group, the camaraderie and the coach and the sort of style and approach they had to training and to climbing that was really positive. And Geek and Buzz, two Neils, they had a similar approach. Geek was the training guy. He provided the training motivation. Buzz was much more chill. And I guess like I always owe him a lot because I feel he like really kind of helped pave the way for me to kind of see I guess like the ethics of climbing and being a good steward for climbing and you know, acting appropriately. I can actually remember, like, you know, me as a youth, I was like really, really energetic, kind of not too dissimilar from now, but really competitive. And I think sometimes I was like, and we came across quite wrong, you know, like I was just too competitive, like too like highly strung. And I remember like there was one kid like fell off a 7A plus and I was eager to get on and prove myself. And Buzz was like, just chill out, Robbie, like maybe just go and do another route instead, because he didn't want me to like make the other kid feel bad. Yeah. So I think, you know, like the two of them together, they kind of like really fostered a really healthy, positive environment, which all the kids benefited massively from. And you know, lots of them today have like gone on to become amazing climbers. Not just myself, like, but also is it Will Bosey, you know, and
yeah, yeah,
you know, like that there, he's from that same group. So yeah, it was really good.
Yeah. And how, what did your transition from, you know, a lot of indoor climbing and competitions to then heading out onto rock and sport climbing in particular look like? What was that journey like for you? Was it just an instant, easy transition? Or did you have to find your own way with it? How was that? Because I know a lot of people find that indoors is a very different beast to the outdoors.
Yeah, I think that it wasn't like a natural. I didn't naturally like go from climbing like relatively hard indoors to hard outdoors. I definitely had to try. I definitely had to like put a lot of time into rock climbing to kind of develop the necessary skills. And I think I was motivated. I was driven to do it. And because I was, I guess, being influenced by Geek and Buzz and they were going out climbing and I wanted to be the same as those guys. I was just kind of up for going on big long trips and getting lots of mileage in. And so I remember like, you know, my parents taking me to Kalymnos and my first trip there and kind of just going out and climbing lots and lots of routes. And then the year after that, my first summer in Sayuse, and I went for 6 weeks and I went on my own. And I was like, I think I would have been like, maybe just turning 17, and I just like wanting to go and do everything, you know, I want to do all the routes in Sayuse. And for basically 6 weeks, I spent like no money because I only had a certain amount of money. I needed to make it last as long as possible. And all I ate for 6 weeks was, you know, porridge and pasta with no vegetables because vegetables were too expensive. And that was how I like, could make the trip last as long as possible. And I got so many good climbs in, and then at the end was massively constipated and had to go home early. I had such a bad stomach. I thought, my stomach's going to explode. Didn't realize what it was until I got home and I hadn't eaten a vegetable in 6 weeks.
Because I heard a different story that must have been a different Sayuse trip maybe, where I think you were only eating Nutella.
Oh, right. Yeah.
Something like that. And it was like, you would just have Nutella and it would just be scooping out loads of it onto just like loaves of bread or something.
Yeah.
But maybe that was later years.
I think that might have been the year after, actually. I think I'd progressed. I think I'd gone from eating nothing but white pasta and porridge. And then I realized I needed vegetables, but also, you know, Crag snacks ended up just becoming Nutella and white bread. So I managed to avoid the constipation, but had massive crashes.
Yeah, yeah. And what kind of when you were going to places like Seiyu's and things like that, were you building up again from that kind of, you know, 7B plus, 7C plus, 8A, or were you getting straight involved with, like, you know, proper projecting and going, right, I'm going to take on something that's going to take me 5 days, 10 days. What did you build a pyramid? How did that look?
Yeah, I wasn't interested at all in projecting. I've never really been interested in like heavy projecting. It's just not something I naturally gravitate to, because I love going climbing and doing lots of different things. But at the time I had this very, I guess like a strict process that I was following to try and become the best climber I could be. And the idea I had was build a big base and kind of like build up. So I wanted to climb 27 C pluses in every style before I moved on to 8A. And then I wanted to climb 28 A's in every style before I moved on to 8A plus. So it took me quite a long time to kind of build up the grades. But what I found was when I did get to the next grade, I was solid at it almost immediately. Mm. I got up to about 8B in that without really doing anything else. And then I found like breaking the 8B plus barrier was the first time I actually had to really put some time in. And I knew that, I realized that I wouldn't be able to continue on this without changing my training back home. And that was the first time I really changed up the training and saw huge gains to break through to 8B plus and then again to 8C. But yeah, early on, when I went to Seiyu's, those trips, I think I climbed every 7C, every 7B plus, every 7C plus, every 8A in Seiyu's, you know, in those first couple of trips. And hadn't climbed anything harder, even though I was probably capable of it, but it would have taken me longer.
Yeah. Well, I know that you went on from, you know, those earlier years of climbing at Seiyu's and climbing the kind of the lower and the mid grades to then do some really impressive stuff in Europe in subsequent years on things like, you know, completing the Alpine trilogy and some much harder single pitch red pointing. And you alluded to that just a second ago about how you really changed up the approach that you took with your climbing and training. How did that look for you? Was that to go back and actually build in more structured training, or was it to put a bigger emphasis on bouldering and strength? How did the kind of the formula work out for you that really brought those improvements through?
Initially, it was introducing a lot more bouldering and strength training into my, I guess, regular training regimes, because I think I guess structure comes into it as well. I didn't have I knew how to structure endurance training, and usually bouldering was something I tagged on the end, with the idea that if I did some bouldering at the end of an endurance training session, I would just get stronger. Mm. But just not realizing that actually to boulder and get your, you know, to build maximum strength, you actually have to be fresh to be able to operate maximally and get the benefits from it. But that just didn't, I just didn't think of that really. And so what I did was when I got to about 8B, that was the first time I really got sort of stopped breaking through the 8B plus. I can remember this 8B plus I tried in Sanya, and these were just hard. They were just hard for me, you know? And I tried an 8C, and again, like, it was the moves that were like, they were just way too hard. So I had to like step up my maximal strength. So I came home, I introduced fingerboard training for the first time. That was probably when I was like, I'm thinking like 19 years old maybe. A bit of campus board training and then bouldering only training sessions where they were shorter and they were really specific. And I would focus on grip types. I would focus on types of moves. I would look outdoors, look at the type of moves I needed to do outdoors and the projects and the type of holds I was struggling with. And I would implement that training, you know, in the prop, that those types of holds and those types of moves on the problems indoors. It was the first time I'd actually approached any sort of like set type of system boards or, you know, the mirror boards that you get, anything like that. And before that, I always thought those things were boring. And I was like, I don't want to do these problems. They're not like set by anyone, you know, it's just kind of dull. And I want to do something that's set by someone with cool moves. But then I started kind of getting into it and realizing that you could really have with creativity and you know, like time, you can actually set some really interesting problems that replicate more what you're doing outside. And so all that sort of stuff came in. And I remember my first trip after I did like basically just loads of bouldering training. I smashed the 8B plus that I tried before, like second go. I was like, Jesus, like this has made a huge difference. And then I climbed another 8B plus, and then I climbed another and another and another on the same trip. Like I remember coming back from that trip, I climbed like 7 8B pluses, and all of them had been like, you know, 2 or 3 days max. And I was just like, Christ, bouldering is good for you.
Yeah.
and then after, I think again, I had a slightly similar approach again. I think I got to about like 10 or 15 8B pluses before I then tried an 8C. And then in the first 8C I did like really quickly. And it was just, yeah, progression like that.
And do you remember when, like 10 years ago or so, how most people were like the number one, which way in which everyone was fingerboarding, it was all repeater work. Remember fingerboarding in the early years was like very, I don't know, it was very narrow. People didn't have much of an idea of these different ways in which we can do fingerboarding, because I feel like it's got so complex now, and there's all these different approaches, and everyone's got that kind of theory relatively dialed down. But back then it was just like, just do repeaters. That's all you do.
Yeah, no, totally. I don't know why that was. Maybe Beastmaker or something. Because yeah. I remember they came up with the repeaters, you know, training plan with their fingerboards, and then suddenly everybody was doing repeaters. And even to me, like at that point, I was still like, it seems like an endurance exercise, to be honest, more than a finger strength sort of exercise. Maybe it's a finger conditioning exercise, you know, more than anything. But I was wary of that. So I think when I started the fingerboard training, although I did repeaters, I was actually doing max one arm hangs assisted, kind of from like pretty early on.
Okay.
I actually like really, really liked doing max hang max hangs, and I would just, at the time there was no other options really. Beastmaker 2000 middle edge, go for the one arm dead hangs on that. Mm-hmm. And I found that really helpful. And the other thing I was really, really keen on was the way I gripped the holds, because I used to see a lot of people kind of like cheating on edges and kind of trying and the way they would hang, and I was really aware of, you know, what I wanted to do with the training. And I used to think like, you know, your forearm is the thing that's actually trying to do the contraction, so it has to work that maximally. I don't want to be getting any extra drag off my skin or cheating the hold in a way. So I was always thinking of that and thinking of how to really make the quality of the exercise maximal, as well as the, you know, as well as the sort of strength.
Yeah. Actually, do you know what? This brings me onto a perfect point that I was almost actually going to forget to talk to you about today, but you've just reminded me of it. And we'll have to make sure that you explain what you're doing for anyone who's listening on the podcast rather than on YouTube. Is tell us about, and I know you've already talked about this in one of your YouTube videos, but can you just talk about the quarter crimp? Because I don't think we've ever talked about this at Lattice, and I know I've tried it a bit with no success, but tell us all about it.
Yeah, so I guess the quarter crimp just stems from my attempt to make things easier for myself. It's essentially a grip I've used for years. And I would say that actually the first time I discovered it was when campus board training. And so I was trying, I remember the first time I started using it was I was trying to do 147 on the campus board. And if you stay just like half crimped normal on a campus run, it's a really intense grip position to be able to engage. So most people end up kind of twisting in slightly, and the index kind of goes quite straight when they campus on, especially on the small rungs. And that's just, I think that's just like a natural thing to do. Maybe with certain people's hands, obviously morphology comes into it, but I think that's just a natural way for an edge to grab. And what I discovered was, as I did more campusing, my thumb ended up gravitating to the index finger and almost doing like resting at the side of it like this. So it was almost like a full crimp, but like not really, not like this. Like it was just supporting the side of it. And I got to the point where I could do 147 solid like that. But when I went to half crimp without the thumb, I couldn't do it. And I decided that I didn't want, you know, for my camera score training, I didn't want to do that. But I always had it in the back of my mind that that was a thing that actually worked. It provided power and extra sort of support through that grip position. And I was aware that it was easier and less, I guess, less energy. It wasn't, it was less energy inefficient to do this than to go into half crimp. So then I started using it actually in climbing. I remember practicing it on endurance routes.
Yeah.
So and typically what it was, if it didn't work, it wasn't the perfect grip all the time. But if you had like a section of crimps where it was very sustained, and you just wanted to, instead of full crimping it, you just wanted to kind of go into a sort of more open hand position, which is a bit more relaxed, then quarter crimp was like perfect. And I could just like boom, 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 really fast. It was very supportive. I didn't need to go into full crimp. It wasn't as pumpy as being in full crimp. And then I also discovered it was a great grip to rest on, because sometimes you get crimps which, you know, it's hard to open hand them and to relax open hand them. But the full crimp feels like it's kind of burning your forearms a bit. So then quarter crimp was perfect. And then I discovered that actually this grip type was perfect for when you've got a crimp, but there's like a blocker on top and you can't full crimp. So normally people would go into half crimp.
Yeah.
But I'm quite weak in that grip, especially when you're tired, or you're pumped, for your forearms to, you know, burn down on like a half crimp edge when you've already done like a bunch of climbing. That's quite hard. So if you use the quarter crimp, it gives your grip extra support, and suddenly it takes a grade off. And so I did, and you know, I've been using it for years, just like it's helped me loads. I use it on almost every route I do, and definitely every session. And I did this YouTube video kind of like sharing it as like a hack. I hate using the word. It was like the hack, the technique hack. Anyway. And people were really kind of like taken back by it. They're like, wow, does this thing work? Some people said it was more injury prone than a full crimp. I mean, I just think it's another grip type. I don't think it's necessarily more injury prone or less injury prone. Might be in some ways, but it's just another grip type, really. Although I don't think it's a great grip for training, I wouldn't use it for weighted hangs. You know, I wouldn't do that sort of thing with it. But I think it's just a great technique to use, to have in your arsenal for anything you're doing, for like hard climbing, because it's just another thing that works. And it's funny because I was aware that other people probably used it, but just didn't have a name for it. And I called it the quarter crimp because it wasn't quite open hand and it wasn't quite full crimp. It was somewhere in the middle, and it wasn't a half crimp either. You know, it was the quarter crimp. And since then, actually, I've seen videos Andre uses them. There's another, the other guy, Hongi. I've seen a video of him using it. So I've seen videos of other climbers doing it, and yeah, it works. And if you get it to, you can figure it out, it's a pretty good thing.
Yeah, I've played around with it a fair bit at work, and I don't know whether it's just I haven't given it enough time, or it's the length of my fingers. It doesn't seem to work very well for it. And we tried it out at work with a number of different people, and we were like trying to hang off the lattice edge and, you know, break the scores. And we were like, oh my goodness, we could, you know, wreck the data set using this. But then we had a go and we're like, oh no, actually, no, we can't. But I think it's fascinating how something can stay so like essentially underground that no one's quite noticing. And then someone like you comes out, you know, makes it a little bit more sort of, puts a bit more publicity behind it in a video. And then a whole load of people go, oh yeah, I've tried that, or I've seen so-and-so use it, or I'm going to have a go at that. And that's how the climbing, you know, evolves and the sport changes, when someone points out something that very subtly we've all been doing and just no one's quite clocked onto it. I think it's very cool. And And even talking to you again now and seeing how enthusiastic about you are, I'm going, I need to have another session with that. I need to spend some more time on that.
Yeah, no, definitely. But I mean, it's just a technique. And I think it's just one of the, I think it's just one of the things that you have to kind of do and get the hang of. And probably like when I was campusing, it naturally sort of like started. And I probably did loads of campus board sessions using it, and it got more comfortable with it. And then eventually, you know, that transitioned to actually climbing with it. But funnily enough, you know, like your paddle hands technique on the cracks, like I can't get my head around that. Mm. But then I've only had two sessions trying it in the bridge cracks. You know, I've not really been back to bridge cracks a lot much, but like I've only had like a couple of sessions trying paddle hands, and I still can't get around it. And I spoke to a friend of mine today who actually repeated your 8A bridge crack using paddle hands. And he said that once he got the hang of it, it was fine.
Oh, and amazing.
So I was like, maybe it is okay, you know, because I was like, Tom and Pete don't know what they're talking about. That paddle hand stuff is rubbish. Like, I can't do this. And there's like my mate Andy going, nah, it's fine, honestly. You just need to give it a bit longer. So yeah.
It's funny, isn't it? Oh. That's what's so great about climbing, and also, you know, the approach, whether you're a coach yourself and you're trying to get someone to learn that and improve in that way, or it's just your own journey. And because it's a nice complex sport, there are so many things, even if you're in it like 10 years, 20 years, 30 years, you're always learning continually. Mm. And like, that was one of the things that I thought, I think there's, When I saw you take on that Alpine trilogy of those really big, hard, multi-pitch ascents over in Europe, and I sort of seen you before then as being a Scottish sport climber, single-pitch, hard ascents, competition climber, and then take on that really big objective and put it out there that you were going to do it as well. That was one of the bits where I thought I really felt like you transitioned as a climber, and really, I hate to say this, and I'm going to have to like put it in air quotes, but like matured as a climber, and you became like, to me, like you stepped up a big level in terms of what you could achieve with that. So I'd love to hear about what changed for you as a climber. How did you take that on? Because it was a big objective, and for most people, quite scary as well.
Yeah. Well, I mean, so I think like where the motivation came from is quite interesting, actually, like the early motivation to do that, because it came from Neil McGeekie, who was like my mentor. And I remember we were doing trips down to Malham Cove. And at the time, I think there was some news in the media that Harry Berger had just done the Alpine trilogy. And Harry Berger was this amazing rock climber and ice climber. And he ended up dying a few years afterwards. But I remember Geek saying, wow, this thing, this Alpine trilogy, it's like, you know, the combination of all these skills, and like, you know, you've got to be the best sport climber. You also got a good head, and you know, you've got to be like the best, like all round climber you can possibly be to do this thing. And he said this to me when I was like 16 or 17. And I was like, that's what I want to do, you know, because that's going to be, I'm going to be the best, you know, like I was just like, that's what I've got to do, you know, to become the best all round climber. And I think like, I didn't touch it then. It was always a thing in my mind, but really know what they were. You know, I just had it in the back of my mind that I wanted to do it one day. And then I think what happened was I went to the Dolomites and did like a Bella Vista, had an amazing experience going Alpine rock climbing with my mate Logan. And then I was like, you know what? This next year is the year I need to try the Alpine trilogy. And so I chose the one that looked, I thought, the coolest, which was Silbergeier. And then just booked a trip to the Alps, went out there in my van with my mate Willis, and just went straight for it. It was like literally no warm-up, just went straight to the bottom of the crag and then started climbing. And that was
just ground up.
Yeah, just ground up. Wow. I just like, literally like walked to the bottom of the route and just started climbing. And the first pitch is 8B/+. And in my mind, I was like, I guess I was 25. In my mind, I was like, you know, I think at the time I'd climbed 8C. I was like, well, I've climbed plenty of 8B pluses, so it can't be that hard, you know? I can climb all the pitches. And then what I learned was actually the style was so intense. That limestone is like so technical. And it was a huge learning curve for me to like adapt to that style and the runouts and it kind of being really scary. But I think I was just really like motivated and really wanted to prove myself. And I think like many, many years of climbing, I guess that sort of grade gave me the confidence to know, to believe that I could do it. But also because I'd done so many red points successfully, I had the skill set and the tactics to approach it in like a way that was probably the most chance of success. And I just took my time with it. I just kind of like went up, learned every pitch. And then first time I went for a ground up red point go, I red pointed it. And that was it. I did it. And I back then I had no preconceptions. I just kind of like went out there fairly like blasé. I was like, I'll just go and try it. And actually when I was on there was another guy trying it, and he was a German climber, and he was I ended up meeting him at like the fourth pitch or something, and we were chatting away, and I was saying, oh, you know, have you been here before? And he was like, yeah. He's like, yeah, I've been trying this for 5 seasons. And I was like, Jesus. And I said, and how has it been going? And he was like, I fall off from the last pitch every year. And I'm just like, oh my God. And I was like, and so how hard have you climbed? And he was like, 9A plus in the Franken Euro. And I was like, Jesus Christ. And as soon as he said that, I was like, this is maybe a bit hard for me. I was like, I don't know what, this is like 3 days in. And I was like, well, I'll just give it my best shot. And then I think like I had one more day or something working the crux pitch at the top just to like make sure I really knew it. And I thought I'd give it a bash like the day after or after a rest day. And then me and Willis came back and then I did it first red point, every pitch just like smashed up it. I couldn't believe it. I was like, flipping hell. So that was pretty good. And then it just like, yeah, every other year after that, I then attempted another one of the Alpine Trilogy. I had a year off in between to do other things. And then I finished the Alpine Trilogy, not last year, but the year before, with the one in the Wilderkaiser, this Kaiser Kleider. And that was it.
And do you think that process of taking on that, you know, really significant challenge, which has got so many different elements to it, that's clearly hard, you know, physically, mentally, tactically, lots and lots of parts that go into that. Do you think that has changed your kind of approach in terms of your self-confidence to take on bigger things and you know, whatever comes to you now, you go, you know what, I've got that in the bank. I can kind of rest on my, you know, Alpine Trilogy version of Robbie. So now I'm just building upon that. So it gives you a level of confidence to go forward. Because I often kind of talk to climbers who say that they really struggle taking on things which they make them feel really uncomfortable, or it's difficult or scary, or there's lots of uncertainty. And they'll look at other climbers who are really good and they'll go, but Robbie has it easy. He always seems to just go for it. And I'm mostly thinking, no, Robbie has spent a long time just building that slow base up and getting that foundation. Was that another big step forward for you?
Yeah, I mean, the way I've approached climbing my entire life is, you know, I'm more of goals and projects, like things I want to achieve, but they are never the end goal themselves. They are just something that I do that gives me another set of skills and that takes me to the next level, and then I can move on to the next thing. And so I think like the Alpine Trilogy, just like my early, you know, sport climbing, just my early competition days, just like my early like days, sport climbing, building up that base, you know, of like 8B plus 8C climbs and doing lots of them, you know, transferring that into the Alpine and doing the Alpine Trilogy. And then progressing from that, going and doing things like big wall routes and LCAP, or even like hard trad routes around the UK. All those things, you just take all those skills, you take all the successes build on your confidence, you become more confident and you feel more likely to succeed. And I think one of the biggest things I've always done is I never approach something with any preconceptions. I like to figure out if I like to find out for myself, you know. Magic mushroom was a funny one as well, because I tried that last year, and you know, if someone had said to me before I went to try it that it was actually like the second hardest route on LCAP, you know, just after the dong wall, it's like the hardest, I would have been like, oh. But I never actually decided to check. I just thought, it sounds like a good route. It's got lots of corners. I like climbing corners. Let's go try it, you know, and see what happens. And then you learn when you're on the wall that, you know, you break these routes into chunks. You can do all the chunks. Therefore, you can do the whole thing. It's just a matter of time. So yeah, I would say like the Alpine Trilogy was like a huge confidence boost for me as well. And I guess knowing that, or understanding that, if I set myself a goal, I can achieve it. I set myself that goal when I was like 16 years old in a car, you know, driving back from Malham Cove, when I was only climbing 7B plus 7C. And then I achieved it when I was 29. So I think, you know, that's, yeah, it was proof. I can do that sort of thing.
Yeah, yeah. Another thing this kind of gets me onto thinking about is that whether over time of having done lots of things now, and I'll give you the context of how I feel about this first, is that I think over the years of climbing now, I've also learned to recognize situations or patterns that would not lead me into doing things and not being successful with a project or a route or, you know, a good day out. And I got good at picking up on those things early to avoid that situation. So for example, I've learned over the years that a huge part of my success in climbing is down to like the energy of my climbing partners for the day. So I've become very selective now over the years of knowing good climbing partners for me, because I can be broken. I'm probably one, just an awful climber if you partner me up with the wrong person. And are there same things that you've picked up now over the years where you go, don't put me in this kind of scenario, or don't combo these things, because that just doesn't equate to success or a good day out or good energy or whatever it might be?
Well, I would actually like say that it's probably very similar to you. Like, partners are hugely important to me. I wouldn't necessarily say like I actively avoid. I would say actively avoid people. You know, I mean, like, I definitely like having, you know, the guys I have get along with climbing. You know, my friends. You know, guys who I know that on the wall, they take it seriously, but they're also totally like up for having a laugh and being silly and not taking themselves seriously. Because if I'm taking myself too seriously before I get on a red point, then I know that it's probably likely I'll fail. Whereas if I'm relaxed and like just like cracked a really, you know, bad joke with my mate and we're all, you know, pissing ourselves laughing at the belay, and then I'm like, right, I'm going to give this a shot, then it's all good. And I can remember like one really great example of this is me and Mish Kemeter. I did Diskaisenoi Kleider, my last of the Alpine Trilogy, back a couple of years ago. And we were at the last pitch, the 8B plus final crux that you top out the mountain on. And I'd had a go. I was really nervous. I fell off, had a wee bit of a tantrum. And Mish was like, oh, I'll have a go. And I was like, okay. He went, he did it. And then it's like, I was just like, oh, now the pressure's on me. And I was like, oh God. And the sun was going down and we were cracking out the headlamps. And I was like, if I don't do this, will Mish come back? And of course Mish was going to come back. He'd bully me like as many times as I wanted. But, you know, these questions and these, you know, things start creeping in. It's like, you're just going to screw this up. And then I had one go thinking all this stuff. Again, it was really bad. And I fell off on the third clip. Had like another tantrum. And then Misha said to me, he was like, Robbie, you went, just keep smiling, you know? And he's such this like vibrant, like really positive guy. And, you know, I was like, he's right. I just need to be happy. I just need to keep, this is what I'm supposed to be enjoying this. I'm happy for Misha's done this. I need to enjoy this, you know? And then I just got on and smashed it. And, you know, we both had set that day and it was like, we were deliriously happy. And so, you know, not if I hadn't had Nish there to say that, it's possible I could have gone into a wee bit of a downward spiral. So it's really important that I have like partners who are super positive. And there's much about, you know, my success as their success, and we basically share all the stresses and all the, you know, the ups and the downs, you know, and therefore the load is a bit lighter, you know.
Yeah. I definitely think there is a certain sort of subsect of the higher end, you know, climbing community, or, you know, pros, semi pros, that are that type of person. And I think, you know, people like me, you, Pete, I think Jörg Verhoeven's very similar again, Sean, there's like a certain group of us that really seem to almost get away with, perhaps we're just not the strongest or the, you know, physically as good as maybe a lot of other climbers, but we bring a certain mixture of energy and stuff to climbing. And that itself is an input into the system, and it gets you up some surprising stuff. Like Ian Cooper is another person like that I've had like some amazing kind of energy days where we go and get up things which are, yeah, like tricky, but it all felt like it was done through essentially a good energy of the crack. And I know it sounds really like hippie like, but it works because I've seen it, you know, for years.
Yeah, 100%. And Ian is someone as well. Ian Cooper is someone that I've like climbed with loads over the years, and his energy is so positive that you know, it's just like a shining beacon of light, you know, in an otherwise really dark scenario that you can sometimes be in. I remember us like abseiling off this big wall in Patagonia in Cochimo. It was dark and we had no idea where on the wall we were, and we were super scared, and he was super happy and chill, and I was like, why are you so bloody happy? Why are you happy right now? This is terrifying. He's like, I'm just keeping the vibe, you know, going. It's just cool, man. It's cool. We'll be fine. And I was like, okay, you know. So with a different partner, maybe it would have gone another direction. But yeah, I just always try and surround myself with super positive people and like-minded people, people that have that good energy. I think it's super important for me anyway.
Yeah. And talking of Cochimo, and, you know, that's potentially one of the only, if, you know, one or two potential 9A big wall trad routes in the world. And that's obviously a, you know, a pretty grand goal for you.
Yeah.
What's your kind of process around goals, and how important are they to you? Is it a big part of your climbing life, and does it kind of drive you? Does it drag you along, or does it push you? How is that for you with goals?
I mean, I think I'm massively motivated by goals.
Mm.
I tend to have really long-term goals.
Yeah.
These are the dreams. This is what I need to work towards. And then everything else is kind of building towards that. And I definitely choose things and choose styles of climbing to get me to these dream things that are kind of like what I want to do one day. I guess like Cochimo one is one of those dream routes. Doing high altitude big wall like in Triangle Towers, that's like the dream. So I just need to see like what style of climbing do I need to do in order to achieve that, what, you know, skills do I need, what all these little things, what, and I just sort of like I look at smaller goals, things that I'll still be really psyched to do and achieve, and just set them out accordingly and kind of just knock them off one by one until eventually I feel like I'm up for the big ones.
Why do you think it is that you find goals motivating for you personally? Because I've come across a lot of people that find them really hard, actually, and they intimidate them, and they lead them into cycles of, you know, procrastination and anxiety. And I think people have a very different, lots of people have very different relationships with goals, but yours obviously seems like a really good thing and a very productive thing. What do you think that specifically goals deliver back to you?
Well, I think is a hard one to pinpoint. I guess like fundamentally, I absolutely love climbing.
Yeah.
And challenge is something that I've always really enjoyed. You know, when I was starting climbing, going to the local climbing wall, you know, I always wanted to be challenged. I didn't want to be on the easy routes. I didn't want, and still like this might sound bad, but I don't really like climbing easy routes very often. You know, like going and doing like, and if I'm doing easy routes, I have to do lots of them. You know, there has to be a challenge in the easy routes. I have to be doing them fast and sort of achieving something in that respect. So maybe it's just because I really, really enjoy climbing and I really enjoy challenge, and that combination of the two goals seem like quite natural for me to just do. And yeah, I think I don't think it's any deeper than that. I think that's pretty much it, really.
No, it's interesting because you know, goal setting is a big part of a lot of people's climbing and aspiration towards, you know, harder, better things, have you frame it up. And most people will undertake some kind of process with some form of goal setting. And I mean, like you, I love goals, and I'm pretty good with adhering to them, whether they're, you know, short term or long term. And I, having spent a lot of time thinking about it and also trying to explain it to climbers or, you know, athletes, clients, I feel like for me, it's because actually, if I really think about it, about goal setting and that challenge thing, because I like that challenge part of the, essentially trying to achieve the goal, the process of it, is that what it actually delivers back to me is it delivers back to me feedback so I can understand and learn more about myself. That's what I actually like doing, is I like learning about my interaction with things and the world. Like, that's like right what it distills down to. I'm like fascinated by it. And challenge is because it's so many like micro setbacks and feedback and, you know, toing and fromming in it. It gives you loads of learning that you can do. And that's what it comes down to. So I've like learned over the years now that if I'm not learning and I'm not doing that challenge part, I'm probably not going to get that much satisfaction out of it. And it's definitely helped me during times of when I've felt demotivated or, you know, had injuries or my project's suddenly not available because I can't travel for a year and a half or whatever it might be. I go back to like, but underneath it all, it's about learning. So deliver that to myself and I'm still quite a happy climber.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, I can't really add anything to that. I think that's probably quite similar. It's kind of a hard one because if people that struggle a little bit, as you said, with goal setting, because I was saying there that, like, you know, I guess it's just because I really love climbing and I really love the challenge. And it sounds quite bad because, you know, are you saying that people who struggle with the goals, does that mean they don't like climbing? But I don't think it's necessarily that. I think that maybe it's just they have a slightly different approach mentally to climbing, and they suffer from more of the stresses and the nerves of and the negative thoughts that can kind of creep in. And I know that for a fact that when I was younger, I struggled a lot with nerves. I struggled a lot with nerves in competitions, and I struggled a lot with nerves in red pointing. And I guess I learned certain mental processes over the years that initially were conscious and that I made to try and battle that, that eventually became just part of my being, sort of semi-unconscious. Usually I'm quite good with dealing with the nerves, and the goals are just, you know, things that motivate me and drive me.
Yeah. So what lies ahead in 2021 for you, talking of goals? What have you got anything planned out for the rest of this year? Because it still feels like, I don't know, there's a lot of unknowns even for 2021.
Yeah. I mean, like, we we were meant to be going to Triangle Towers last year, and we had to cancel that, obviously. And we had initially thought, right, well, we'll just push it forward to 2021. And at the beginning of this year, I was pretty certain it wasn't going to happen, but I kind of was like, well, you know, maybe we can just kind of like keep an eye on things and see how everything opens up. And as things have gone on, I've just been like, yeah, we're not going to try and go this year at all. That's not happening. So we'll just push it forward another year. And honestly, I would say that over the course of the last couple of years, I have fallen in love again with British climbing all over again. I've definitely, like, British climbing has gone up and down for me over the years. Sometimes I'm like really psyched on it, and sometimes I just want to go abroad. And usually I do at least a couple of trips abroad every year. So it kind of, it's kind of fine, you know, but I know now I am like really, really, really excited for British climbing. I can't even think about going anywhere else. I am so motivated by exploring Scotland, going down to Wales, trying like some hard trad routes in England. I just want to go and, you know, be a British climber and have like a really good summer and autumn in the UK, and just climb lots of cool British stuff. So I'd say, I think the thing I'm most psyched on at the moment is a project I have up north, which is at this crag called Duntelchig. I think it's going to be about E10, 8C sort of climbing. It's fairly safe up until the last few moves, and then quite sketchy. And that's the hardest part of the climb. So it's pretty bold in that respect. And I've trained very specifically for it for a very long time now. And I think I would love to see that get done. I'm a bit concerned that as the year kind of goes on and our lockdown continues a bit longer, that the conditions are going to get worse and worse sooner rather than later. And so it might, I don't know, I'll have to see what the summer is like, really. Because if I'm not going to get up there until like May time, I might be struggling. I don't know, because some of those crimps are absolutely heinous. So yeah, I'd say that's probably what I'm most psyched for.
Oh wow. Well, I think a lot of people in the UK and probably worldwide with the lack of travel now are getting into their regional climbing and learning to get back into the things that are local to them, because there mostly isn't another option. And I think overall that's a good thing, because we've all had too much luxury of being able to travel all over the world wherever we want, and we forget that actually there's some really good local backwaters which deliver really good climbing. And it all has taught everyone this year that whole process of reframing stuff, because, you know, if you don't learn how to take something that you do have right now in front of you and reframe it as being a good and valuable thing, then it's a skill that you'll miss out on in life, because it becomes very useful when, you know, for example, when we have setbacks and things like that. So
yeah,
I think it's good.
Definitely. I remember Aidan Roberts said the same thing in his film, you know, about this. And he was like exploring Lake District and doing all those hard bouldering and saying how it was just as good as, if not, you know, better than other places where people are always looking abroad. They're always looking at the grass is always greener on our side. They want to go to Bishop. They want to go to Hueco Tanks. They want to go to Rocklands or whatever, or Seyous. But I think we've got great climbing in the UK. And I think in the UK is really good, and it transfers really well. Like, I think in particular for me, like what my big wall aspirations, I think being a British climber is the best training for for going and doing bigger stuff and scarier stuff, because British climbing is just really technical and bold, and there's so much variety in the rock, and the gear placements are so finicky often. And I think that we can, you know, if you have a good apprenticeship or a good amount of mileage in the British style, then you can take it abroad and do amazing stuff with it. So yeah.
Yeah, for sure. Well, thanks so much for taking an evening out to chat with me, Robbie. It's been really cool to I mean, every time I chat to him, I was like, oh, I just got such good energy. I'm feeling really psyched for climbing again now. So it's really cool. And I've already had my cellar session today, so I haven't even got any energy to go and do some more climbing later on this evening. So I'll have to call it a day for today. But where can everyone find you? And I know, in fact, what's the name of your YouTube channel? And then tell us about also where you are on social media and everything like that.
Yeah, sure. Well, we've got a YouTube channel. It's just my name, Robbie Phillips. So just type that into the search box and you'll find me. And
put it in the links below as well.
Yeah. And they're just a mixture of, training videos, outdoorsy climbing videos, us doing hard stuff, us doing funny stuff. Just a good mix, really. It's me and my friend Cullen O'Brien who do that. And yeah, I'm on Instagram as well. Robbie Phillips_ and that's pretty much it, really. That's kind of like the social media. Oh, we're on TikTok now. That's an experiment.
I'm on there too, Robbie.
I know you are. It's not my cup of tea, honestly. It's not. My girlfriend Mary, she's really psyched in it, so she made us a TikTok account and she's making us do all these really cringy things.
Well, welcome to the world. Next time I see you in person, we'll make some TikToks together. Then you'll get it.
Sounds like a plan. I'm excited.
Oh, brilliant. Well, have a good rest of the evening and lovely to chat to you again, and I'm sure we'll catch up in person soon.
Nice one, Tom. Catch you later.